Good morning. This is Irving R. Levine in the NBC newsroom in New York with the World News Roundup, direct and transcribed. Major developments and on-the-spot coverage by correspondents at the scene this Sunday, June 19th.
A new edition is in store for NBC's big weekday morning lineup. Your old friends, Fibber, McGee, and Molly. Yes, Fibber and Molly move into the morning lineup 5 days a week, beginning Monday, June 27th, just 1 week from tomorrow. You'll be able to follow the McGees both in the morning and in the evening. So remember that date, Monday, June 27th, 1 week from tomorrow. Now, here is the World News Roundup.
The city of San Francisco will be greeting a great assemblage of distinguished diplomats from around the world. The occasion is the 10th anniversary of the United Nations. President Eisenhower will fly from Washington to San Francisco later today aboard his personal plane to deliver the opening address tomorrow for the week-long festivities. The Secretary General of the UN, Dag Hammarskjöld, arrives in San Francisco aboard a tourist-class flight rather than a first-class flight, thus carrying out his own directive to members of his staff that they use the least expensive means of transportation. Except for Mr. Hammarskjöld's praiseworthy tourist-class economy, in other respects, the 10th anniversary celebration shows every sign of being a first-class affair. 10 years ago, representatives of 50 nations heard then-President Truman deliver an address at the signing of the Charter. Tomorrow, the 50 members will have increased to 60 over the past 10 years. Most noteworthy, though, is the fact that despite criticisms and disappointments, the United Nations is a vital, respect-commanding organization today. So much so that almost 40 nations will be represented by their highest diplomat, their foreign minister at the San Francisco sessions. It's also a subject of happy comment that the 10th anniversary ceremonies come at a moment when the world atmosphere is more of peace and goodwill than at almost any time since the Cold War began. This atmosphere is reflected in a number of ways, major and trivial. Russia's foreign minister, V.M. Molotov, accompanied by 50 aides, arrived by train after what appeared like a goodwill tour across the United States. He waved pleasantly to a crowd at the station and delighted his porter with a $17 tip for his services on their cross-country trip. Tomorrow night, Mr. Molotov meets at dinner with Secretary of State Dulles and the foreign ministers of Britain and France to discuss the forthcoming meeting in Geneva next month among the chiefs of state. Other signs of the prevailing international climate, our UN delegate Henry Cabot Lodge has expressed optimism for the release of the 11 remaining flyers held by Communist China. One of the four pilots recently released, Captain Harold Fisher of Iowa, is going to San Francisco to thank personally United Nations leaders who helped obtain his release. Overseas, improved relations are reflected by an event in Japan. There, Russian officers have delivered to American officials 10 small ships, infantry landing craft, which we lent to the Soviet Union during World War II. The transfer took place pleasantly and smoothly, with a Russian commander complimenting American newsmen present on the performance of the American ships. Of course, one of the most startling communist acts of recent days is the decision by Communist China to release 5 United Nations prisoners, 3 of them Americans, 2 Belgians, who want to come home now after having chosen 2 years ago to remain in communist hands. We get the latest on that story as we call in Tokyo and George Thomas Folster. Let's try again for that Tokyo circuit. Come in, Tokyo, and George Thomas Folster. We regret that our communications with Tokyo apparently have broken down. The story from Tokyo, as gathered from news dispatches, is this. The release of the 3 GIs is awaited momentarily. The question is whether they will be released through Hong Kong, or what seems more likely at the moment, that they will be released through Panmunjom, which of course was the true center at the conclusion of the Korean War. And of course the return of the 3 former GIs will raise a number of problems for Washington. The Army has declared the men dishonorably discharged. But are they civilians if they have not physically received their discharge papers? And if they are civilians, how does the Army punish them, since the truce document specifically provides no punishment for the prisoners who elected to stay with their captors? What is Washington's reaction to the Chinese move? For that story, to Washington and Roger Kennedy.
What are the motives behind the release of the three turnabout Americans by the Chinese Reds? Congressman Walter Judd of Minnesota expressed the general Washington attitude, saying, "This is a cold-blooded, calculated thing. The communists never do anything out of humanitarianism." Off the record, State Department officials spelled out one thesis which may explain not only this latest gesture, but also the temporary informal ceasefire in the Formosa Strait and Red Premier Zhou Enlai's recent statement that the communists would try to liberate Formosa by peaceful means. According to this theory, China is a starving giant. A recent drought in southeast China set spring planting back 10 weeks, and crops are very thin. This is serious, for last year, the communists mortgaged their agricultural production, exporting farm products in exchange for heavy machinery. They're hoping that a big harvest this year would make up not only export needs, but domestic shortages caused then by floods, which ruined nearly 10% of China's farmland. So, a combination of last year's floods and this year's drought have put the Chinese armies on short rations, and farmers all over China are reported angry and restless as communist officials arrive from the cities to take away most of the scarce supplies produced this year. So it's probably searing droughts and a severe grain shortage that are forcing China to assume a temporarily pacific manner, at least until this year's late food crop can be harvested. This is Roger Kennedy in Washington.
Also on the international scene, a suggestion from a senator on how to avoid an atomic war. Wisconsin Senator Alexander Wiley has proposed that the next time the United States tests a hydrogen bomb, we should invite United Nations members, including Russia, as well as representatives from Communist China, to witness the explosion. It's the thesis of the senator from Wisconsin that the awesome sight would deter one and all from starting a war. A report on a Sunday disaster after this message from your announcer.
In summertime, many sections of our country become dangerously dry, and this increases the ever-present danger of forest fires. Every year, thousands of acres of timberland are destroyed by fire. Now, that's a tragic loss of natural resources almost beyond belief, and the tragedy becomes even more appalling when we realize that this loss is unnecessary. Most forest fires are caused by human carelessness. You can do your part to prevent forest fires by following a few simple rules when you're out in the fields or forest. Crush out cigarette, cigar, and pipe ashes. Break matches in two after using them. Drown all campfires, then stir and drown them again. Find out the law before you start any fire. Forest fires can be prevented if we all do our part. Be sure to follow these simple rules and see to it that others follow them too. Forest rangers can fight forest fires, but remember, only you can prevent a forest fire. Now back to Irving R. Levine in New York.
One of the great sources of strength of General Juan Perón, president of Argentina, has been the nation's army. Today, it's beginning to appear that the army may now be ruling Perón rather than the other way around. There's nothing definite, but the communiques coming out of Argentina in the wake of the brief uprising by Naval Air Force units give that impression. Censors in Buenos Aires have permitted correspondents to send dispatches saying, perhaps significantly, that the army now has taken over the job of safeguarding public order apparently from the police. The army has posted guards in Catholic churches in the capital today, and priests have been warned not to include any political comment in their sermons. Although there's no fighting in Argentina at the moment, it is evident that the crisis has not passed and that Perón's control may have been somewhat weakened by the events of recent days. In Latin America and here at home, a number of airplane disasters. A four-engine passenger plane has crashed in León, Mexico, killing two and injuring 10. In North Carolina, an Air Force jet pilot is missing and believed to have crashed. Five other jet pilots flying Navy planes took off from Texas yesterday, ran into bad weather. Four managed to make emergency landings, but one crashed. The pilot is believed to have bailed out, but is missing at the moment. There's also a serious accident underground in New York's subways. We get that story from Bill Fitzgerald.
A near major tragedy on New York's racing subway early this morning. One train coming into the Coney Island station, another going out. Confusion with the signal lights, and both trains crashed head-on. Latest reports say that upwards of 40 persons were injured. Apparently, there were no deaths. But one motorman was trapped in the wreckage, and it's said now that he has been extricated and is in serious condition. Police disaster units and ambulances rushed to the scene when first reports of the accident came in. NBC reporters were there too and described the first moments as ones of anxiety. No one knew how many were aboard the two trains, and the results could have been extremely serious. But when police and rescue workers dug into the smashed cars, they breathed a sigh of relief. No one was dead, but the injured were everywhere to be seen. It could have been much worse. It was early morning. The usually jammed subway was almost empty. Everyone shudders at what could have happened in the rush hour. This is Bill Fitzgerald.
An important decision in the use of the Salk anti-polio vaccine, the decision to continue inoculations during the summer peak months of polio. What with hydrogen bombs and all, some Americans tend to regard our British friends with admiration for their apparent consistent equanimity. However, we've run across this item today from England. A leading British psychiatrist has told a medical conference that one out of every three prescriptions issued under Britain's National Health Scheme is for sedatives to calm the nerves. I'll be back in a moment with the rest of the news.
Is someone blowing out birthday candles at your house this month? Perhaps one of the youngsters? Well, make it a special birthday. Give them a United States savings bond. Giving birthday bonds is a good custom in many American homes for many good reasons. It teaches youngsters the value of money, the value of saving. Now, they take pride in watching their collection of bonds grow. It teaches the meaning of interest, too. Now, you explain how savings bonds pay back $4 for every three put in. And just see the impression that makes on a youngster. And it should. Savings bonds are a wonderful investment. And then, last but certainly not least, give them savings for the future spending, possibly even to use toward their college education. They'll be proud having savings of their own to spend. So begin giving birthday bonds at your house. A United States savings bond is a gift that keeps on giving. Now back to the World News Roundup.
It's not necessary to be a golfing fan to appreciate the story from the Open Golf Championship at San Francisco. It's the story of a little-known underdog suddenly rising to championship stature. One of the favorites at the annual golf tournament was Ben Hogan, a longtime professional and consistent big-money winner. As anticipated, Hogan shot the lowest score yesterday, but the surprise is that his score was matched by a virtual unknown named Jack Fleck, 32 years old, a former caddy from Davenport, Iowa, who makes a living running two municipal golf courses in his hometown. Fleck had never won a major tournament before, tying the old master Hogan at this most important of tournaments in the golfing world. Today, Champ Hogan, who has won this Open Championship four times, will play for the title against challenger Fleck. Win, lose, or tie again, Ben Hogan can derive considerable satisfaction from the fact that his opponent uses golf clubs which bear the manufacturer's label, Ben Hogan Clubs. And there's today's World News Roundup, produced by NBC News. This is Irving R. Levine saying goodbye from the NBC Newsroom in New York.
Keep tuned to monitor the new NBC radio service. This is Monitor, going places and doing things. Take one.